From wars to censorship to cultural issues, you're with Mark Morano and Unleashed on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right. Breaking news. We told you about the story about the United Nations warning of 2 years in order to save the planet. Well, I have the video today of the UN climate chief, UN climate spokesman, making those very claims. If you recall, this was immediately shot down by a top UN scientist, Michael Oppenheimer, who called the UN claims of 2 years to save the planet meaningless rhetoric and counterproductive. But we'll get to that in a second. We'll get to those his reaction. But this is United Nations Executive Climate Secretary Simon Steele. It's incredible because they actually think you're a moron, that you're stupid, that you're an idiot, and that you'll fall for something like this as a persuasive tactic. I actually respect them more when they just authoritarianly say, we're declaring an emergency. We don't give a flying F about you. This is our plan and we're imposing it upon you, which is what they've done successfully from energy, food, transportation, free speech, COVID lockdowns. But it's where they get insulting is when they actually think they're convincing you. So let's see, Executive Secretary for the United Nations Climate Organization, Simon Steele, warning of 2 years left to save the planet. And I'll go through, try to do point by point of some of his key points.
So, 2 years to save the world. Good afternoon. Some of you may think the title of today's event is overly dramatic, melodramatic even. So let me start by explaining why the next 2 years is so essential in saving the planet. First, we know the stakes. You've heard me talk about time and time again the shattering heat and massive damage that climate change is causing to our economies and how there is no room for half measures. Let's take all of that as a given. Second, we are at the start of a race which will determine the biggest winners in a new clean energy economy. And with the global index of living standards in constant flux, each country's climate responses will be key to whether they rise up the ladder or fall, whether they thrive or barely survive. Third, for many countries, they will only be able to implement strong new climate plans if we see a quantum leap in climate finance this year. Fourth, it's about how the Paris Agreement works. As of today, national climate plans in aggregate will barely cut emissions at all by 2030. We still have a chance to make greenhouse gas emissions tumble with a new generation of national climate plans, but we need these stronger plans now.
Let me just take a few key points there. This is truly a revelation speech because you get into their mind. They have climate national plans. And the only thing that matters to these unelected bureaucrats is an old saying, who voted you in? Who hired you and how do we fire you? And obviously no American, no Canadian, no Australian has control over this guy. Yet he's talking as though we have no choice, like John Kerry's daughter. We have no choice but to do this. National climate plans, that's all they seem to care about. We have to meet our targets, our national climate plan, the 2 degree, which we've already pointed out, the 2 degree Celsius plan, 1.5 degrees, was literally pulled from thin air, according to top UN scientist, when the ClimateGate emails came out in 2009, Phil Jones. And then there's been subsequent matters on that. It's been so much. That is a fraud. That's a political rallying point. No basis in science. They're talking about unless we act, the economy is going to be massive economic damage, is what he said. The only damage the economy is going to face from anything climate related is climate policy. Wouldn't you just love to see an actual debate at one of these summits? They would never in a million years agree to it. In fact, if you said a word, you would be declared a climate denier, and you'd be declared a conspiracy theorist. You'd be a science denier and a conspiracy theorist. He said that we've had shattering heat waves. You can look at this from any perspective you want, particularly here in the United States, 1930s, about 8 to 10 times worse heat waves. 75% of all the heat cities and states heat wave records occurred before 1955. We were much warmer in the 1930s in terms of heat waves. And it just goes on. He's talking about all these things, which are just sort of checkbox, checkbox, checkbox. And then he throws in that whole thing at the beginning, where he throws in the whole thing about 2 years left to save the world. And his exact quote, who exactly has 2 years left? The answer is every person on this planet. What does that sound? It sounds a little COVID lockdown. We're all in this together. That's right. We need to create a billionaire every single day. And we need to transfer wealth from the poor and middle class to the wealthiest Americans and globalists. And you've got to, we're all in this together. We've all got to achieve our goals. This is our plan. And again, the national climate plans are all they seem to care about. Well, kudos to at least UN lead scientist Michael Oppenheimer, Princeton University. 2 years to save the world is, quote, meaningless rhetoric. At best, it's likely to be ignored. At worst, it will be counterproductive. And this was actually quoted in the Associated Press, the top UN scientist pushing back on such nonsense. But I just wanted to follow up because we had the video. I was able to obtain the video of Simon Steele, the UN climate chief, babbling out this nonsense. And this is, again, they think they're convincing you. They think that you're an idiot. Okay. Speaking of climate, this is an interesting moral dilemma. There's an old thing with the American football NFL. You make the call. They pose a situation where you're presented with a problem on the football field and you have to act as coach, and they give you like two or three options. You pick one and then they show you what the coach did and the reaction. Well, I'm going to do the same thing here. You make the call. You are stuck in traffic with Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil protesters, funded by Hollywood millionaires, funded by billionaire foundations from the Getty Foundation and Rockefeller. You make the call. What would you do in this situation? Would you sit there and take it, or would you do what this driver did? And I'm not condoning anything. Clip three.
Watch out, watch out, watch out. Watch out, let him through, let him through. Out of the way, out of the way, out of the way, Pat. Out of the way, Pat.
And there you have it. He just plowed his way through. I've shown you other footage of, I guess it was tribal police breaking him up off the highway and being very rough with the protesters. And of course, we had the situation on the U.S. Constitution, the National Archives, where they poured, I think it was orange paint on the case holding it. And by the way, it's just a matter of time before some paint seeps through, hits an old document, some paint seeps through, damages an old Van Gogh painting or some priceless piece of art. We already know the Brandenburg Gate in Germany, they're saying it's going to be, I don't know how many millions, but years before they can go up and clean it and restore it, because that was sprayed with paint by these, again, don't focus on the protesters. It's who's funding them, who's behind them. They're doing the bidding of our ruling class, of our governing elite, of academia, of Hollywood, of the billionaires. And this is Epic TV. I've been telling you about this series, a documentary I was in for Epic TV. They sat down with me for an hour. I just wanted to play another clip. This is me talking about how they're centrally planning every aspect of our lives on Epic TV. Clip four, roll tape.
These are people who have a vision of a world, and it's a utopian vision of this world where everything's going to be ordered, everyone gets their fair share, to each according to his own. And the idea is anything short of that has to be micromanaged and corrected. So in order to achieve that goal, they've come up with crisis after crisis after crisis. That's what's scary about it. It's a central planned vision of the world that you could never even achieve in previous generations, but you could achieve it now in the digital age. They actually believe if we're allowed to live our lives unrestrained, if we're allowed to do what we were, what have been doing in America with freedom and freedom of movement and prosperity and middle class values, that we will destroy the earth, we'll create a climate crisis, environmental degradation, white supremacy, essentially cause a huge race war, everything. They think we will literally are unable to take care of ourselves. So therefore, they have to come in, manage, plan, and manage every aspect of our lives, masterminding from above like we're puppets. And it's not like, oh, that's going to happen. That's been happening at an accelerated pace.
Wow, who is that guy? That's fantastic. Okay. You can go to Epic TV and try to download that. I don't remember if they usually make them available to the general public. Otherwise, you may have to register on their website. You might get a few free, or you have to be a paid subscriber, but it will be available, the whole thing, soon. But I love Epic TV is one of the most phenomenal one of the most phenomenal news outlets in the world today. And what I was just saying there is exactly the world in which we are facing. And this goes back, you know, throughout history, the ruling class governing elite has tried to find reasons why the rest of us can't be free. And in my book, The Great Reset, I quote a BBC historian who did a phenomenal analysis on the abuse and use of emergency powers. And this historian's conclusion was that emergency powers, during times when government declares a crisis and declares emergency powers, that's when the greatest violations of human and civil rights occur throughout history. And he went back to analysis of ancient Rome, the Roman Republic's descent into the Roman Empire, centralization of power in the Middle Ages due to emergency power abuse. He went through 1940s Germany and the use of emergency powers, which essentially put kept Adolf Hitler in power. And then, of course, we talked about 9/11 emergency powers. We talked about the COVID emergency powers. We talked about the climate emergency powers that they want to do. I've also quoted Sol Freelander, the UCLA historian, who is a Holocaust survivor and wrote of the Nazi regime and totalitarian regimes, they use the bureaucracy to enforce magical beliefs. And that is a dead-on accurate provision. This whole idea that we can't be allowed to be free because we will destroy either the earth or each other, create destruction, inequity, violence, goes back thousands of years of human history, obviously, and especially with thousands of years of organized government. It's a way to seek power for those who are on the other side, those who want to control us. It's a very simple concept. And in the United States, the 1913 is when the administrative state was presented to Woodrow Wilson. Remember, Woodrow Wilson did the League of Nations, which later became the United Nations. And the idea was we would lead our lives by credentialed experts because we're basically not smart enough and we're not studied enough. Why not let the best and brightest, the people with the best educations, the Ivy League universities, the people who with the rich parents who can send them off to these schools. Now, a lot of these kids that were sent off, in the case of Al Gore, his father was a U.S. senator, the climate Al Gore, and he went to Harvard. And in the words of Warren Buffett's right-hand man, who's Charlie Munger, he said Gore basically failed out of Harvard, but he got a gentleman C, which is a gentleman C is where the school knows they can't fail the prestigious student of a U.S. senator who was going to, you know, Al Gore, whose father was a senator at the time. And so he got a gentleman C. But it's these credentialed class who believe that they can rule over the rest of us. And this goes on in the 1930s during FDR. I detail this in my book. A man named Stuart Chase came forward and came up with a primitive version, not even primitive, it was almost a carbon copy of the Great Reset for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was a socialist economic advisor, Stuart Chase, to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1938, I believe it was. He came out with the government takeover of agriculture, energy, transportation, and free speech. It was incredible. They literally, it sounded like Klaus Schwab was 1930s was presenting this, and this was the World Economic Forum. This is the world in which we live today. And it's because of this legacy. So right now we have our hands full. I still can't believe last hour, Tom Harris, how crazy the Canadian laws. I mean, Justin Trudeau can lose the election, but you can't remove him from power. He just continues on and on. And he really may be like Fidel Castro, his rumored father, he may be the president for life of Canada. And he's not that old. So that could go on for quite a while. Okay, I have one more clip and then I have a special announcement. But here we go. This is, just so we understand, and I like to ground this a lot, this is Greenpeace co-founder Dr. Patrick Moore, who was referenced by a lot of my guests, because he's one of the best scientists out there. He really is, and best communicators of the science. He explains why we are not in a climate emergency. Dr. Patrick Moore, he's been a guest on this show, and he will be again. He's a Canadian co-founder of Greenpeace. And by the way, he was a co-founder of Greenpeace. We know this because Greenpeace's own website listed him as a founder for decades. And once he became prominent as a climate skeptic, Dr. Patrick Moore, and became anti-science and a conspiracy theorist, Greenpeace, in collusion with Google, said, hey, he was never a co-founder of Greenpeace. And they stripped it off their website. And guess what Google did? You search for it. Google used to have the image of Patrick Moore as one of the co-founders of Greenpeace. Once Greenpeace colluded with them, his face disappeared, just like Joseph Stalin would make commissars vanish. There was a book called The Commissar Vanishes about Joseph Stalin in the 50s. You know, these Russian officials or Soviet officials who fell out of favor would be airbrushed out of photos. That's what Greenpeace did. What saved the historical record for Patrick Moore is the Wayback Machine on the internet showed that Greenpeace's own website listed him as a founding member of the original Greenpeace, and they couldn't scrub the Wayback Machine, even though they scrubbed their current website. So we had a lot of fun with that. Anyway, Greenpeace co-founder, and I say that proudly and accurately, Dr. Patrick Moore, about why we are not in a climate emergency. Clip 6, 5.
There is an awful lot of well-known people who appear to have credentials saying that we are in a climate emergency, which we are, aren't we?
No, we are not in a climate emergency. These people want us to think that the world began in 1850 when we started using fossil fuels. But for 150 years before that, it was also warming. There is zero evidence that the CO2 increase in the atmosphere is the cause of rising temperature. None whatsoever. Because it was already rising, and as I was about to say, during the first 150 years of rising out of 1700, there was a period of over 40 years where the temperature increased more and faster than it has done since 1850, especially since 1950, when we were actually starting to put a significant amount more CO2 in the atmosphere post-war. And today, it's exponential. There's a wonderful graph, it's in my book, which shows the temperature record in central England from 1660 or so, when the first thermometer existed. So this is the longest thermometer record of temperature in the world, because they were invented in England. And so that shows a very steady, continuous rise in temperature of a little over 1 degree Celsius in 320 years. It's not a big deal. They keep saying it's never gone this fast. It's never risen this fast. That is a lie. It has risen this fast many times in the even recent past, especially from about 1690 to about 1730. It rose faster and longer than it ever has done since. It's all in the record.
It's all in the data, it's in the science. And this is, we had Tom Harris on last hour, the International Climate Science Coalition in Canada, where Patrick Moore is from. I wish that the opposition party to Trudeau in Canada would bring in some kind of speakers like Dr. Patrick Moore to present to him. It's just so disheartening to think the politicians are still playing that game of climate's a problem and we're gonna capture carbon and plant trees, yay. Okay, special announcement before we go to break. This is standinthelight.uk. How do you fancy a bank holiday weekend at a music festival for Truth and the Freedom Tribe with 30 awake artists? I did not say woke, awake artists, including Danny Rampling, Mobius Loop, and an all-night acoustic fire pit, bouncy castles and Hope Sussex for the children, plus loads of amazing stalls and scrumptious food vendors. This is an event not to be missed by anyone who's aware of the truth of the world. A Stand in the Park and Light paper present. Stand in the Light a Truth Music Festival in the beautiful Lake District on May 24th to May 27th. You get 4 days of camping, full access to the whole festival for just £60 plus a booking fee. Children under 5 come free. There's no better bargain anywhere. Visit the website now to make sure you don't miss what is going on to be a brilliant weekend for the whole Freedom family. StandInTheLight.uk. See you there. Okay. When we come back, we'll take a break. Tyler O'Neill, managing editor of the Daily Signal, the Heritage Foundation's news outlet, a fantastic daily must-read for anyone out there. They do the just yeoman's work on every possible topic. Passionate advocates for free speech. He's going to be talking about the corruption of historical civil rights group and about free speech in America and news reporting. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned for Tyler O'Neill of the Daily Signal coming up after these breaks.
TNT's Rick Munn.
Surely basic common sense should overrule any need for any report when it comes to this. I mean, is this the only time in history that a report would even be needed or be commissioned and take 4 years to write? To stop mutilating children, to stop messing around with their puberty and with their development, to stop indoctrinating them and assisting them to destroy their bodies before even the age of 18 in some cases. Surely that's basic common sense. At no other point in history, certainly that I'm aware of, in the United Kingdom or Ireland, has this been facilitated before. It's only been in the last, decade or so that this has started to become a thing that doctors and teachers and parents and politicians have actually gotten behind and encouraged.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
JDRF's vision is to create a world without type 1 diabetes. The type 1 diabetes community is at the heart of everything JDRF does. We were founded by the type 1 diabetes community. In the main, we are governed by the type 1 diabetes community, we're energised by the type 1 community, and we're accountable to the type 1 diabetes community. It's on their behalf that we exist, and it's on their behalf that we must succeed. JDRF exists to rid the world of type 1 diabetes. It's easy to say, but it's hard to do. So for us, that means rallying all the resources and all the people and all the organisations required to make that a reality as quickly as possible. The world's best researchers, exciting innovative companies, and the passion of the type 1 diabetes community, then delivered through the health system so lives get better every day, day after day, until the day we find a cure. To everybody in the type 1 diabetes community, no matter your age or stage with the disease, whether you were diagnosed recently or a long time ago, we need you to know that we are here working on your behalf to deliver a world without type 1 diabetes as quickly as we can. Thank you to everybody who's supported JDRF in so many ways. You are making our vision of a world without type 1 diabetes possible.
Today's News Talk Radio.
Now we're talking!
TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program now is Tyler O'Neill, managing editor of the Daily Signal, the Heritage Foundation's news outlet. He's a Hillsdale College graduate, which is a fantastic university. He's also the author of the book, Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Welcome to the program, Tyler.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, why don't we start there? The Southern Poverty Law Center was one of these august historical civil rights groups. 50s, 60s fought for the against segregation in the South, fought alongside, I believe, Martin Luther King. How did they get corrupted? What's their message now? This is a civil rights group. Shouldn't they be standing up for everything from free speech and open debate? What exactly is the corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center?
So ironically, the Southern Poverty Law Center is not one of these older civil rights groups from the 50s and 60s. It started in the early 1970s. So, and we think noble civil rights group because it represented poor people in the South, giving them legal representation in its early years, which is true. But then by the time of the 1980s, it became very focused on suing KKK groups into bankruptcy. And it's interesting, you know, going after the Klan is something most Americans support. However, what many of the lawyers who signed up to help poor people in the South said was that this was like shooting fish in a barrel. I didn't sign up for this. I signed up to help real people who need help. And they all quit en masse in 1986. And you see this shift from noble civil rights cases to fighting the Klan to running out of Klan groups and then desperately finding a new source of hate that they can keep raking in money. And where do they turn but to ever more increasingly mainstream conservative and Christian organizations?
And so how does that actually look? So what groups have they gone after and how do they demonize them? How do they turn a mainstream Christian organization into a hate group? And does the government listen to their recommendation? Is the Biden administration all ears? Was the Obama administration all ears to their recommendations?
Yes, terrifyingly so, yes, to those last two questions. Okay. But the real, the longer answer, you know, starting in the early 2000s, the SPLC decided, hey, we can, you know, they can kill two birds with one stone. They can put their ideological opponents on the hate map, thus delegitimizing them. And they can, by doing so, exaggerate the number of hate groups in the United States, scaring donors into ponying up cash. And if you look at the hate map over the years, you'll see that many of the organizations on there either barely exist or are these laughable, you know, like social clubs that consist of only a few people, and the SPLC is demonizing them. But then the SPLC started adding groups that advocate for conservative causes. Organizations like the Federation on American Immigration Reform, FAIR, which is pushing for closing our open borders, imagine that, the Center for Security Policy, which was warning about the threat of radical Islamic terror in the early 2000s. But of course, they're an anti-Muslim hate group. And FAIR is an anti-immigrant hate group. And then you look at an organization like Alliance Defending Freedom, which is one of the premier civil rights organizations in the United States that represents people whose free speech and religious freedom have been undermined. And ADF has won multiple cases at the Supreme Court, and yet now they're on a map with chapters of the Ku Klux Klan because the SPLC says you're an anti-LGBTQ hate group. So, I mean, the real question is, what's the next category going to be? And in 2020, last year, we saw them add parental rights groups to the hate map. Interestingly, they didn't say that these are hate groups, but they did put them on the map with the Klan. And they said they're part of an anti-student inclusion movement. And this includes, you know, groups like Moms for Liberty, Parents Defending Education, you know, the moms and dads who went to their school board meetings complaining about schools being closed during COVID, and then talking about the radical ideology that's being foisted on their kids. Radical ideologies like critical race theory that teach children to judge each other by the color of their skin, not by the content of their character, and like transgender ideology. And the SPLC has been pushing this stuff for a long time through its Learning for Just. This is another funny thing that gets me every time. They had this program for education called Teaching Tolerance, right? But then in 2019, they decided that tolerance wasn't woke enough. So they decided to scratch the name Teaching Tolerance and replace it with Learning for Justice, because somehow that gets at their woke agenda more specifically. So the really scary thing about all of this, and I mean, a lot of conservatives like to laugh at the SPLC because they think being put on the hate map is a badge of honor, because a lot of conservatives know that this group has no credibility. The thing is, the White House needs to hear that. Because according to SPLC President Margaret Qualley, the Biden administration in the early days reached out. And this isn't just like the White House. This was the White House, the Department of Justice, the Department of Education. They reached out to the SPLC for advice on combating domestic terrorism. Now, this is an organization, you know, the SPLC, the hate map inspired an act of domestic terrorism in 2012 against the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. The man who found the SPLC on the hate map, or found FRC on the hate map, went to FRC with a semi-automatic pistol and a bag of Chick-fil-A chicken sandwiches, said he wanted to kill everyone in the building and smear a Chick-fil-A sandwich in their faces. And now this organization is the one that the Biden administration thinks is credible on domestic terrorism, so much so that they're going to them. And then they released this domestic terrorism strategy in the first year of the administration. And we've seen, you know, the SPLC has been working with them. The Obama administration cited the SPLC in previous years. There was a FBI training in 2014, and then another FBI document last year going after Catholics. But this is the nefarious influence that this organization has, and it has no credibility. I mean, another aspect that I should have mentioned was that in 2019, the SPLC fired its co-founder, Morris Dees, amid a racial discrimination and sexual harassment scandal. You know, this is, you know, Me Too visits a civil rights group. And a month later, the president is acting like nothing happened, compares the SPLC to the Underground Railroad, and now they're advising Biden in the White House.
Wow. We're talking to Tyler O'Neill, author of Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center. It seemed like when Biden administration, wasn't their Justice Department actually considering a lot of these parents at the school board meetings against critical race theory, against COVID theater, against Black Lives Matter being taught, or against transgenderism? Weren't they labeled by the Biden Justice Department some kind of domestic terrorist? How did that work? And was that direct influence of the Southern Poverty Law Center?
So we don't have the direct tie with the SPLC on that specific incident, but that was with the National School Boards Association, which it later came out, you know, Miguel Cardona, the head of the Department of Education, had requested this letter, and the letter compared concerned parents to domestic terrorists. It led to a Department of Justice memo and this threat tag, which by which the FBI monitored parents at these school board meetings. And so, yes, and I think there is a tie to the Southern Poverty Law Center. I think the tie is that after this got revealed and after the NSBA withdrew the letter and everybody apologized, suddenly, you know, the SPLC is coming out against parental rights groups a couple of years later. And there have been meetings between the White House and the woman who runs the hate map. So, I mean, you put two and two together. I think what happened was everybody learned about the NSBA thing. There was outrage, justly so. The Biden administration said, all right, let's tiptoe around this for now, and then let's come back with the Southern Poverty Law Center and ramp up a new round of this. So I'm watching the Biden administration for another, you know, the other shoe to drop, because nothing has changed with the exception of the fact that Americans spoke out against that. But all of the underlying issues that led to that letter, that led to the FBI memo, are still there. And the left, and I think the Biden administration, still views parental rights groups as a threat to domestic tranquility.
Wow. Well, let's go. Who funds the Southern Poverty? Is this grassroots activism and doing the will of the people, or is this a shadowy funding, billionaire funding? Yeah, you know, we find out like Just Stop Oil, Extinction Rebellion. Turns out it's all these billionaire foundations, Hollywood celebrities, Hollywood directors giving. They're doing the bidding. Is it similar here? I mean, this isn't coming from African Americans across the country giving money to declare all these conservative groups domestic terrorists. I'm assuming the money's coming from another source.
So there are a few different sources. The SPLC started with a donor list from the 1972 George McGovern presidential campaign. So that's where they got their start. the donor list that Morris Dees created. So there is some grassroots support. At the same time, you do see the left-wing funders, you know, the Open Society Foundation from George Soros. You do see some involvement with the dark money types, with Arabella Advisors and their front groups. And you see, you know, the funny thing about the SPLC is because it has this history and it's viewed positively, and then they worked up leading up to the Charlottesville riots, they had long been pushing this, you know, this narrative that
Here's a bushfire fact. Bushfires can occur without warning. So if you're traveling during bushfire season, here are three simple steps to remember. One, check the fire danger rating before you go. The higher the fire danger rating, the more dangerous the conditions. It may be safer to replan your trip. Two, think about the area you're going to and what you would do if a fire started. How would you escape the area if you needed to? And where would you go? Check if there's a neighbourhood safer place. Three, it's dangerous to drive through smoke or fire. If you can't find a way to avoid the fire, park in a cleared area, face the car towards the fire, and turn the engine off. Then lie on the floor and cover yourself to protect yourself from radiant heat. Live bushfire ready. For more helpful tips, visit myfireplan.com.au today. The Kids Cancer Project funds vital research into childhood cancers. And you fund the Kids Cancer Project. Funding research means giving children back their lives. And who knows what kids with cancer could grow up to do? The Kids Cancer Project. Survival starts with science. Donate now.
The Kids Cancer Project.
Unleashing the Beast. Mark Morano is unleashed on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to TNT. We're talking with Tyler O'Neill, author of Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center, also the managing editor of the Daily Signal. You were just talking about the funding, if you just want to recap that, because we had to go to break and they had a glitch there. So just give us a recap of their funding and where where this shadowy money might be coming from.
Yeah. So the SPLC has funding from many donors across the country, but also funding through the Arabella Advisors Dark Money Network and funding from the Open Society Foundations. There are a couple of other when the Charlottesville riots happened, the SPLC had another version of its hate map that was the map of Confederate statues and monuments across America. And this map didn't just include statues of Robert E. Lee, you know, statues of some really bad Civil War Southern fighters that really shouldn't get statues. But, and I think Robert E. Lee, you know, there's more debate on that. But there was a guy who founded the KKK. Anyway, it's a complicated issue. The SPLC treated all of it as evil. And then they also included high schools, middle schools, elementary schools on the list, military bases. And this was when left-wing protesters, rioters, were going to these statues and pulling them down. And so it scared me. Anyway, they were leading up to Charlottesville, and Charlottesville happened in that context. And so when it happened, a whole bunch of big donors decided they were going to funnel money to the SPLC because they thought the SPLC had credibility on this issue, which it doesn't. And so you had the George and Amal Clooney Foundation shoveling money at them. You had CNN pasting the hate map all over their website. Oh. You had many of these big donors. So you have millions of dollars flooding to them. And this is both from the shadowy left-wing funders and from the more obvious funders, and from a large amount of Americans who are unfortunately being hoodwinked by the ideology and by the rhetoric of this group.
Now, I mean, let's go back here a second. Like you were talking about suing the Nazi party members back in the 80s. I mean, other than watching Geraldo Rivera's old syndicated show, I don't think I've ever seen a Nazi ever. I mean, the only place I've seen him on those daytime talk shows or some of the media ledges. What, first of all, is there, you know, how did they, how many groups were there to sue? You said they tried to get him out of existence, or, but how many even were there? It just seems like this is a complete media creation to think that there's all these Nazi groups, or were even, even when Geraldo, I think he had the chair broken on his nose in the late 80s. It was more just for entertainment and theater. No one actually believed that we were overrun with neo-Nazis in America.
Well, so these were KKK groups.
Okay, okay, KKK. Okay,
so there are a few Nazis, sure. You know, a few neo-Nazis. But your question is still a good one, because yeah, the KKK, its heyday was in the 1920s, and then it had a little bit of a resurgence in the 1950s. And by the 1970s, they were a spent force. There were only a couple of them that still existed around then. And there was one, to the SPLC's credit, there was one case where a black man was lynched in the late 70s, early 80s, and they represented, and their big win is getting the group that was behind that lynching suing them into bankruptcy. But here, this story really reveals so much about the SPLC, because that group only had about 50 grand to its name. When the SPLC sued them, they got a multi-million dollar judgment. It was like $7 million. It was incredible. And they get this $7 million judgment, right? So what they get, they only get $50 or 50 grand from the group because it doesn't have any money. So it takes that 50 grand and it gives it to the bereaved mother of the poor guy who got lynched, which is like, okay, good. Well, what does she do? She takes that money and she pays it to the SPLC, because the SPLC had given her a loan for housing. So all the money that they get from this group goes right back to the SPLC. Meanwhile, the SPLC goes to their donors and says, we got $7 million from this group. We're making a huge impact. Send us money. And they get $1, $2, maybe $3 million from their donors, none of which the poor bereaved mother gets. And by the way, this mother also wanted to tell her story in a movie. She tries to go and sell her story, but Morris Dees had gotten there first. So she couldn't get a movie of her story made because the Southern Poverty Law Center was already controlling that narrative. And so they pushed her out in these various ways.
Well, this whole idea of hate, disinformation, misinformation, are they related at all? Or do they have any affiliation? It sounds like the same tactics at the Center for Countering Digital Hate, because in 2021, I was dishonored as the digital hater number one by that group, the Center for Countering Digital Hate. So two questions. Is there any connection between the Southern Poverty Law Center and that? And secondly, give us this definition of hate that they bandy about. Let's go a little deeper into that. But the first thing is Center for Countering Digital Hate. Is that just a wannabe Southern Poverty Law Center?
Yes, I believe there is a direct connection. And it's been a little while since I've looked at that particular organization. But they are in the same sphere. They're doing the same sorts of things. And I think they have former or current staff in common. But okay. I have to check on that. The SPLC does have offshoots in Canada and the United Kingdom. And even, you know, there's another one called GPAHE, the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, which was founded by Heidi Bayrick, who is the former hate map, you know, czar at the SPLC. So their influence is spreading, and they're part of this big movement. So it wouldn't surprise me at all. The other, and your other question is
define hate at this point, because they're saying that anyone who challenges sort of climate change consensus is guilty of toxic and digital hate, toxic rhetoric. I mean, what do these phrases even mean at some level? Is there an actual definition of what they define hate as, Southern Poverty Law Center?
So the SPLC puts out this definition. The definition is that their definition of a hate group is any organization that, through its public statements or the statements of its leaders, defames or attacks people based on typically immutable characteristics. It's very interesting that they say typically immutable characteristics, because that way they can get immigration status in there, which is not an immutable characteristic. I mean,
but also wouldn't gender's fluid now. So you couldn't insult a woman because they could be a man. You can't assume what they are, right?
Yes, exactly. So like, and this is a very sticky definition. So naturally what happens is Antifa will go and throw Molotov cocktails at a, at a police station, at a justice building, a courthouse. And the SPLC will say, oh, well, that's not hate. And look away, you know, they'll carry water for Antifa doing real violence. And then people will, you know, protest against a drag queen story hour, and they'll say, oh, this is hate. This is evil violence. Like, yeah. How dare you? And it's like, one of these is actually causing damage and threatening life. And the other one is a peaceful demonstration of opposition. And the SPLC treats one like it's the end of the world, and the other one like, oh yeah, that's just another day. You know, it's like the CNN reporter standing in front of the riot and saying, oh, these are mostly peaceful protests.
All right. Well, we only have about 10 minutes, or not 8 minutes left. I wanted to move on to some other topics, but one final question, Center for Digital Hate. Is there anything we can, like, what's happening to sort of rein this in, especially any collusion with our federal government or with the administration in power? Is there anything we can do other than just, as you're doing, exposing it? Is there any congressional bills, anything where there's got to be certain criteria for federal agencies to actually, you know, look at what is a domestic terrorist, what is a domestic hate group?
Yeah, well, it's very hard to have specific. So like, I think sunlight is the best disinfectant for these sorts of things. I'm constantly following, covering, trying to draw attention to this. You should check out my book, Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center. There are a lot of really good groups working on this. When it comes to concrete policy, the main one, and I'm not sure how far this is going, but there are a lot of former, you know, FBI whistleblowers who are saying that what we need to do is either completely dismantle the FBI or disarm the FBI so that the FBI can only be an agency to investigate people, not actually carry the guns themselves. And that will force them to work with local law enforcement, who are often far better at resolving the real issues that are facing Americans than these federal law enforcement agencies, with the exception of ICE and DHS, which we need to beef up, because you might have noticed there's a crisis at our southern border.
Yes. Of course, you're a hate group if you're opposed to that. Well, it seems as though the left has corrupted so many American institutions, whether it's the Justice Department, whether it's even places like NASA. The old NASA lead scientist, James Hansen, was arrested half a dozen times protesting global warming, endorsed a book calling for ridding the world of industrial civilization. And you have what you're describing here, the Justice Department. How do we take back American institutions from this activist ideology? I mean, look at what happened with Twitter, with all the intelligence agencies and all the Twitter files revealed all this collusion to shut down free speech. What's the path forward to turn this around?
You know, that's an excellent question. This is such a broad, there are so many different crises that are facing America right now, from, you know, the border crisis, from this crisis of weaponizing government against American citizens, and from clamping down. I think we have to talk consistently about what happened during COVID and how the federal government abused its authority by forcing these tech companies, you know, really, really pressuring them to silence Americans. I'm really grateful for Elon Musk and for what he's done for changing Twitter to X. I mean, I actually like the name Twitter, so I'm a little bit sad that he's moved away from that. But he has really championed free speech there. There are a few signs that he's not going, you know, that he's not going to have everything. And what we have to do is constantly emphasize the importance of these issues. And, you know, the Heritage Foundation has a large array of potential reforms. You know, we're looking at Section 230. We want changes to Section 230. I am not following specifically where we are on those policies, but I know that we are pushing for reform. And I think it's important to have more sunlight on these issues and really for the American people to understand what's going on. I mean, our elites are clamping down on dissent. And the climate narrative is one of the scariest because, you know, I've been reading books by Abigail Schreier and Jonathan Haidt about what is, you know, why the young generation is facing this mental health crisis, this crisis of confidence. And if you are constantly telling young children that the world is about to end because of the climate, because of what human beings, you know, the basic things that we rely on for the prosperity that we often take for granted today, that's going to lead them to go crazy. And many of them have gone crazy over this. And it's like the evidence is simply not there. And one of the reasons why we see the elites trying to silence debate on this issue is because there is no smoking gun connection to specifically how carbon emissions have somehow created this catastrophic climate change. It isn't there. And so many scientists claim, you know, it's interesting. In the 70s, they said it was going to be a new ice age. In the 90s, when I was growing up, they said it's global warming and we're all going to, you know, Florida is going to be underwater by 2010 or 2000 or whatever. Florida's still there and the property values are only going up. And Obama got his seaside mansion. Like there is no way these people really believe that the world is about to end, but now they have climate change. So they can retroactively blame whatever does happen on human causes. And what this does is it puts a massive weight on the shoulders of young people who don't know, you know, they don't know that the evidence isn't there because they're being told this conspiracy theory, you know, this terrifying nonsense over and over and over again. And it's like, look, carbon emissions could have an impact on the climate. Do we know what that full impact is? No. If we did, we'd be able to predict things more clearly. What we do know is that the climate is really complicated. And by the way, our carbon emissions have been going down because our technology is getting better. And that's not because it's being forced by the government, but because it's becoming more efficient. So what we should do is trust in our, you know, have an all of the above approach. Focus on increasing some carbon emissions now for the long-term benefits of having new forms of energy. And by the way, one of the best forms of energy, nuclear energy, is zero carbon emissions. And like if climate alarmists were serious, they would say, let's get on nuclear energy yesterday.
Yeah, it's more about control than actually solving it. And the other big thing about the climate agenda is all of their solutions wouldn't even reduce emissions. I mean, going to EVs, 500,000 pounds of materials. I mean, you can go on and on. It's just all virtue signaling for saying you did climate action. All right, you have about a minute left. You're the managing editor of Daily Signal. Final question. What kind of censorship has Daily Signal faced? What kind of fact checks? What kind of restrictions on your access have you experienced pretty much since COVID in March of 2020?
Well, so since COVID, the Daily Signal has not faced specific actions. We have faced specific actions on the transgender issue. Actually, our YouTube videos have been censored on that. But we've really been covering, and I think what's great is for now, some of these companies have been scared into not acting as harshly because so much of what they did during COVID has been exposed. So one of my biggest articles was where Facebook admitted that it censored often true content because that violated the Biden administration's narrative on COVID.
Wow, I mean, Can you imagine if this, you know, this hippies in the 1960s, if they say, oh, no, you're slapped with a disinformation because you disagree with the Pentagon's assessment of the Vietnam War. Then well, no one would have accepted that. But we accept that today. You can't disagree with any government claim or it's automatically. Well, thank you so much. Tyler O'Neill, managing editor of the Daily Signal from the Heritage Foundation, also author of the book Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thank you for joining TNT today, Tyler.
My pleasure. Thanks again so much for having me.
All right. And this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. See you next time.